Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 11, Chapter 18, Text Number 35. Yadrichchayo papanhanam adyas chrestam utaparam tathavasasthathasaiham praptam praptam bhajanmune yadrichchayo papanhanam adyachchaishtam uthaparam tathavasasthathasayam praptam praptam bhajanmune yadrichchayo papanhanam adyas chrestam uthaparam tathavasasthathasayam praptam praptam bhajanmune. Let's admit that first word's a bit daunting, isn't it? It's a bit like super fragile Kalanistic espialidosis. You heard that one? That's a Mary Poppins. Yadrichchaya, of its own accord, apapanna, acquired, anam, food, ajat, he should eat, shrestam, first class, uta, or, aparam, low class. Tata, simile. Vasasaha, clothing. Tata, simile. Shayam, bedding. Praptam, praptam. Whatever is automatically obtained. Vajet, should accept. Munhi, the sage. Translation. A sage should accept the food, clothing, and bedding, be they of excellent or inferior quality, that come of their own accord. Purport. Sometimes excellent, sumptuous food will come without endeavor. And at other times, tasteless food appears. A sage should not become happily excited when a sumptuous plate is brought to him, nor should he angrily refuse ordinary food that comes of its own accord. If no food comes at all, as mentioned in the previous verse, one must endeavor to avoid starvation. From these verses, it appears that even a saintly sage must have a good dose of common sense. one poem by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, where he says that man's glory lies in his common sense. What's the rest of the verse? Which dictates him the understanding that, forget the rest of the verse, everything lies within the Lord's embrace. Some verse like that, but an important part of that is that man's glory lies in his common sense. A good dose of common sense described here. Not just a little bit, but a good dose. So, actually, it's a quality which is very much lacking. Common sense. Quite often, especially in the modern Western educational system and throughout the world, people are graded on their intelligence, but very rarely graded on common sense. So we actually have, there are many people who are very, very intelligent. And some of them, some of those intelligent people are brilliant, genius. But many of them are lacking common sense. And therefore, despite that, you know, wonderful facility of very high intelligence, it becomes, they're not really able to take advantage of it. It's like having a 16-year-old who's just got their license, because these days it's what, 18, 21, something, you get your off your P plate, something like that. I think 18 is it, and get your license. When I was driving, you could get your license at about 16. Back when I was driving, you could drive, you know, without a license. I think I went just about all the way around Australia driving before I ever really got a license. But if you give a new driver a very powerful car, then because of their inexperience and their impetuous nature, it's a very dangerous thing. Therefore, you see, they're trying to bring in laws to restrict the sort of cars that new drivers can have. So similarly, one may actually have a brain that is, you know, a superior mechanical device than other brains, and yet the person operating that brain, their level of consciousness is not very elevated. Srila Prabhupada was actually discussing this point of because, you know, we associate a person's intellectual ability with their you know, the material brain itself, but he gives the example of a typewriter, or you know, maybe when he was typing these Bhagavatams or what have you, originally he was using a you know, non-electric typewriter. Right? So he was just ticking away at the keys. Still, because the person operating that very, you know, primitive type of typewriter, primitive to us today, because his consciousness was very advanced, He was able to take that simple machine and do very wonderful things with it. So he was able to produce the Srimad Bhagavatams. Whereas today you get people who have the most sophisticated computer devices, but because the person operating them is of a less consciousness, they just produce rubbish. So the brain is like that. It may be the brain is a machine, and it may be capable of simultaneous computations and great intellectual work, such as some of our physicists and mathematicians and astrologers and what have you. But if the person operating that brain, the soul, is not very developed in their consciousness, then they can't really get the full effect out of that brain. Whereas sometimes we see this sometimes, especially amongst Western devotees who have had a misspent youth, let's put it that way, and maybe destroyed a few too many brain cells, and yet although the brain, the machine, may actually be a little bit dysfunctional, because the person operating that brain, their consciousness is very elevated, they can do, their intelligence seems to be quite extraordinary. So this common sense common sense is something we can apply really to the operator of the brain. So someone who has, whose consciousness is a little elevated, then they will have some common sense and an ability to utilize the body and the mind, the brain, in a very nice way, so as to get the full value like that. But generally we see actually this common sense is lacking. In other words, the consciousness of the operator of the body and mind is not very well developed, and therefore common sense is usually not showing, and despite their great intellectual potential, they end up doing something foolish. So as devotees, that common sense should be there as well. Here we see that there are some slightly different instructions. Instructions for living very simply and accepting that which comes of its own accord, and at the same time maintaining one's body and soul together nicely. And while that's all going on, at the same time looking after the interests of serving the Supreme Personality of Godhead and the devotees and the spiritual master. So there's a lot of different factors going there, and without common sense one cannot reconcile what to do in any situation. So therefore you see that people who want to imitate the life of a saintly person, sometimes you may see them walking around the streets barefoot. And I know where I used to live in Waiheke Island, off the coast of Auckland, New Zealand, there was one man who used to wear orange robes, and he'd walk around, and basically all his belongings were on the end of a stick, tied in a little bag. So it appeared that he was, you know, very saintly, very renounced and what have you. It was a very small island, so everyone knew each other. But really, having seen, you know, the activities of this person, he was, you know, just completely full on into sense gratification. He was just completely into, in other words, his real motive for living that simple life was that it actually gave him opportunity, one, that a lot of foolish people were attracted to him, including, you know, young girls who, you know, were attracted, though. He was this, you know, wonderful, free, mystical person, and, you know, what have you like that. And of course he would, you know, use all his opportunities in a very exploitative way. So, you know, he was basically just after sense gratification. But it appeared that he was very, you know, just living almost according to this verse. It appeared like that externally, but really, if you look into it, it wasn't. And then we see sometimes that, you know, some people, including devotees, live very, very opulent lives. That facility, you know, may be there without a lot of difficulty, and one may consider that perhaps they're not following the Srimad Bhagavatam, and that one may unnecessarily criticize them. So, it's not always obvious how to practice these principles. We see in the Nectar of Instructions, it's also described that one should not unnecessarily endeavor for mundane things which are very difficult to achieve. You know, that over endeavor. So then one may think, so if I, you know, I shouldn't over endeavor, should be just very peaceful and calm. And then there may be some service that one is doing for Krishna where a massive amount of concentration and endeavor sustained over a long period of time may be required. And one may be thinking, oh, I should not over endeavor, you know, this is too difficult, so perhaps we should follow the instructions of the Nectar instruction, we'll just, we'll not do this service, you know. So surprisingly, you know, I hear these things all the time, and, you know, devotees say these things all the time. In one sense, it's a little comical, but the actual reality is that most people get this wrong, even amongst many devotees. They struggle to properly see how to accept things which come of its own accord, and at the same time properly maintain the body with some endeavor, and at the same time put their full endeavor and full concentration into the particular services that really need to be done, the needful that needs to be done. Generally, to some degree, you know, most devotees have a sense, so they have a basic sense that they should give as much time as they can to serving Krishna, the Supreme Lord, because ultimately at the end of this life they want to go back to the spiritual world, and they particularly want to go back to Krishna Loka. So they have that sense, and therefore they know that by doing that there are some things, you know, on the material platform which they will not be able to endeavor for, because they don't have the time. If they're going to serve Krishna and do a lot of service for Krishna, therefore some of these things on the material platform, pursuing, you know, particular education or, you know, career or, you know, different things. Maybe they're into painting or music or something, and they may have to actually shelf some of that to some degree in order to sacrifice to have, you know, enough time to pursue Krishna consciousness, you know, seriously. So most devotees have that basic sense there. The non-devotees, of course, do not have that sense at all. They always working very, very hard for sense gratification, which is very, very difficult to achieve. Always, you know, they can have a simple home somewhere, but they want, you know, a must-have the two-story in a nice suburb. You know, they can have a simple car, but no, it must be, you know, this particular car, you know, convertible with, you know, sporty, and, you know, it's the wrong colour. We'll have to pay another couple of $1,000 to change the colour. You know, they can wear clothes, but no, it has to be the latest fashions, or that will cost you 10 times the amount. You know, you can buy something to wear for, you know, $50, $100, you can deck yourself out for a year, you know. or it's, you know, $500 is not enough just for, you know, a couple of items just to get you through the season. So, in this way, they're endeavouring for very, very difficult things. And most people in this world spend their entire life, not just part of it, but their entire life, always working for something which is difficult to achieve, and many of them never achieve it. And while they're doing that, all the things that Krishna has supplied to them that they will never have to endeavour for, they're not interested. So we see sometimes that they have people have an opportunity to marry, and someone has just written a book recently that men and women should start looking for, they're looking for the wrong things in relationships. You know, generally, you know, most women or men, they will want, these days, their partner has to be very attractive. You know, someone who can make them laugh. You know, some good job. You know, well dressed. You know, they have a lot of different qualifications, but actually when you go through all of the qualifications which usually people look for these days for marriage, none of them have any bearing on happiness in marriage. You know, if you take them one by one, none of them can guarantee a day's happiness when they get married. You know? Whereas there are certain qualities that a woman should look for in a person they're going to marry, and a man should look for in a person they're going to marry, a woman, that actually guarantees that that marriage will be happy. You know, you would want a person who is friendly and, you know, affectionate, able to, you know, both of them able to work together to, you know, maintain a nice, clean standard of living. You know, that's an important thing when you're living together. If everyone has a nice standard of cleanliness in the home and their personal habits, you know, very hard to have a happy marriage when the partner you're living with is a slob or a sloth. You know, a sense of the person has a sacrificing type of nature that they're able to work, as one unit and make sacrifices so that they're not always just putting their own agenda first. There's a lot of different things, we won't go into it. But generally, although many people have the opportunity to perhaps select a marriage partner who is not very difficult to, almost on the doorstep, but generally that they will overlook that person because they have some other crazy idea in their head that there must be this, must be that, and they chase that all their life. And even if they get that, they then don't become happy, and then just continually searching, and then they go through relationship after relationship after relationship, always searching. So it's just an example how people can waste their entire life striving for something which is always very, very difficult to achieve, but that which is actually presented to them without any endeavour by the Supreme Lord, they're not interested in. Just like, again, happiness. If we look at how hard people are working to be happy, right? There's a massive amount, 5-6 days a week, plus bringing their work home, working in horrible situations, horrible jobs, because they've got to get a certain amount of money. They don't, I think happiness starts at what, about $7.50 a week or something? Is that right? These days, there's some, under that there's no chance, right? And then gradually it goes up, to a big smile when you're about $1,500 a week or something. So they have these conceptions, so they, they make themselves absolutely miserable working for happiness. And they even forget, after a while they're so into the competition and just caught up and entrapped in illusion, they even forget why they started. So then after so many years of miserable, they forget that they're just trying to be happy. But how difficult is it to be happy? There's a beach, you can walk, there's a beach 5 minutes down the street. You take a walk, you're happy. You sit down on the grass, and you have a little prasadam, you might read a little something. You talk to a friend for a few minutes, you're happy. It's just so easy. Get out in the sunshine, have a swim, play with some children. Happiness is—it just takes no effort at all. Every single person, including all living entities, pretty much their arrangements are there, their allotment, and even in the poorest situations. Happiness can be there, just having good company and good conversation and a little something to eat and what have you. A little sleep when you're tired, you wake up, you feel happy, tired, have a little nap, you wake up, now I'm happy. It doesn't take much to be happy. And literally everything we need to be happy comes of its own accord. The water's there, the sunshine's there, the beaches are there, the grass is there, the trees are there, the birds are singing, the butterflies are, there's so many things. But all those things, no one has any interest in them anymore. All the things that Krishna has provided, which come of its own accord for happening, no one's interested. No, I have to... I have a 5-year plan, and if I can work, really hard, maybe 2 jobs, and balance this and balance that, and maybe I'll do some studies at the same time, perhaps, I'm not definite, but there's a chance in 5 years' time, if I'm successful, I may get a chance at happiness. That's how people think. And then 5 years come, and then, oh, I'll have to make another 5-year plan because I'm actually somehow, I don't know why, but I'm still very miserable at this. And they just spend their whole life like that, chasing. So, that is the non-devotee. So, let's say that the devotees, at least, you know, that basic understanding is there, that that is a waste of a lifetime, a futile endeavor. Happiness is so easily achieved by the grace of the Lord, and we should accept those things, which practically there is no endeavor for, but literally supplied by the grace of the Lord. At the same time, there should be an understanding that we're also trying to, because happiness is automatically achieved, really one doesn't have to put a lot of effort into that. Therefore, the next point is, so I have a whole lifetime. I don't have to work very hard for happiness. Happiness is easy. So let me give all that time and energy and, you know, experience that transcendental happiness, ananda, that unlimited happiness, that spiritual happiness, which comes from pleasing the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So for that, then devotees will endeavor to satisfy the Supreme Lord. They will endeavor very, very diligently and with their full effort and full concentration. For that, they will give everything. Because in that spiritual activity, the transcendental pleasure is like an unlimited ocean, always increasing. Every endeavor that's made is not a futile attempt like the material endeavor for the happiness, but is actually a very fruitful, very rewarding activity. Therefore, for instance, personally, on a particular day, some prasadam may come along, and on some days, the prasadam may be, particularly tasty. Whoever has cooked, their consciousness, their expertise, their service to Krishna, and that I know that the feast yesterday was, I thought it was wonderful. But some days, the prasadam that comes your way is very, very, very nice. And sometimes the prasadam that comes the devotee's way, the cook may not have, may not be very expert, might not have done so very well, may not have had so many ingredients, and it, may not be such a high quality. So a devotee would just accept anyway, because they're very happy, because they're still thinking, here is prasadam, this is the Lord's mercy, and they're just so grateful to have prasadam. A devotee should never ever forget that. I remember the two first times I had prasadam. Well, you can't really have two first times, but the first and the second. The first time I had prasadam, I didn't know it was prasadam. I was at a rock concert somewhere about 1975, and Daddy Cool doing the Eagle Rock and the Mile Music Bowl, and the devotees were there, and they were they had an interval, and they started distributing plates of prasadam. I'd never seen devotees before, and I could only see them from a distance, but I said they were chanting. I think they were even chanting on stage. They started distributing in the crowd plates of prasadam. So a plate came up towards me, and I looked at it, and I couldn't recognize it. I've never seen such colorful food. I was thinking, you know, there's something yellow, there's green, there's, you know, there's this biggest potato chip I've ever seen, you know, just, I was thinking, that's, you know, instead of have a whole pack, just one big one. And, you know, there's all the different colours, and I was, gee, you know, this is, but I was still, you know, because in those days they'd had, I think it was at Jim Jones, where, you know, it was about, 700 people, mass suicide or something, you know, from some, there was a lot of pseudo cults and that, and there was a lot of trouble. So I didn't really, I knew nothing about them really, and I thought, I don't know whether they're just going to poison everyone in the audience, you know, because I don't know who these people are. So I didn't want to eat it, you know, even though it looked quite good. So I took the poppadom, and I don't know why, but I took the tiniest little bit and I thought, I'll honour it because they've distributed it, and I ate it, and then I put the rest aside. So I actually honoured the prasadam, you know. And I thought, if there's poison in it, because they're distributing it, if there's no poison in it, I've accepted something, like as a reciprocation. But if they poison it, it won't kill me. So I had a little bit and I put it aside. Probably the next time I had prasadam was when I first came to the temple. And I'd actually, you know, it was following the kirtan party around the city. And the first time a devotee ever really spoke to me, actually his first words really were, "Do you want to come back to the temple?" And at this stage I'd actually read the Bhagavad Gita and Nectar Devotion. And I said, yes, I will. So I came back to the temple and I'd read about prasadam. So then I sat in the reception here for a Ramaswami, and he said, it was about 9 o'clock at night or something, he said, "I'll get you some prasadam." And I thought, oh great, I've read about prasadam, you know, really looking forward to prasadam. So you know, he searched around, he came back with one or two very, you know, crisp, over-fried, tiny little scraps of pakoras. They're real crunchy and, you know, like dark, blackish brown, you know. But I actually ate them happily, you know, as prasadam, you know, like that. You know, now, of course, if you serve that up to the average devotee, they'll look at that and think, well, you know, you offend her. What are you doing? You know? So we have to be very careful, you know, how our consciousness can change to, you know, our attitude towards prasadam. We should always maintain that understanding that here is Krishna prasadam, you know, whatever state it's in. Because we can't imitate Raghunath Das Goswami, but we should, you know, have an understanding that this is Krishna's mercy. And you know, it's when there's a loving relationship, you know, whatever that person prepares, whatever the reciprocation is, when there's actually love, you would just accept it immediately, you know, like that. Whereas something may be more wonderful, but there's no love and the motives are wrong, you're not very interested about that. So that's, you know, prasadam, that's what we're tasting, that loving reciprocation between Krishna and the devotees, and that's there. We should be very careful. Now, at the same time we say that, that doesn't mean that we should be, you know, serving up to, you know, the guests, just like last night we had so many hundreds of guests. We shouldn't be, you know, that the cooks just get in the kitchen and they're, you know, yakety yakety yak, you know, sometimes you go in the kitchen, they're talking about everything but Krishna. They're talking about, you know, yeah, I'm going to get this car and, you know, I'm going to put the, you know, sometimes it's like that, you know, go in the kitchen. And, because what happens, of course, is you get a couple of brahmanas who are perhaps trying to cook in the right consciousness, make a nice offering for Krishna. And then you may get, because it's a big feast or festival, a lot of helpers who are really untrained, and the brahmanas who are in there must, you know, really keep, they have to check the consciousness of every single person in that room. They don't do it as much, I see, these days as what we used to do. But previously, you know, it wouldn't matter how crowded the kitchen was, the first time someone talked something non-Krishna conscious, or even spoke when they weren't supposed to, there was, you know, someone would turn around and just check them, you know, concentrate, do your service. Why are you talking like that? And even if they're talking about Krishna consciousness things, if they're, you know, just getting into this whole conversation and they're rolling these puri dough or something, you can see that, you know, is that a puri dough or is that play dough? You know, what are you doing there? You know, sometimes they may even have to just stop talking Krishna Gita and concentrating, make the preparation properly. So that doesn't always happen. Now, if from the kitchen, you know, a whole lot of burnt pakoras and over-fried papadums and, you know, burnt sweet rice and what have you comes out, and we serve that to the guests for a feast, the devotees shouldn't be thinking, yes, I'll just accept what comes, and, you know, and we'll... Now, guests, we should teach the guests to think like that as well. And just, you know, whatever comes is our way, we shall accept. No. Because then, you know, we applying this, you know, principle that, you know, we're serving Krishna and we're endeavouring very, very hard with full concentration, full effort, full devotion to please Krishna in the best possible way we can, and one of our most important opportunities and facilities that we have for helping people to become Krishna conscious is prasadam. And therefore a devotee may be happy, you know, just to take, you know, prasadam as it comes, at the same time being very, very careful to make sure that they're maintaining their health properly, you know, in Krishna's service. But they should also be thinking that, you know, for the health and welfare of the general devotees who are eating prasadam regularly, and they should also be, you know, thinking of the, you know, attractive quality of that prasadam as far as being able to, you know, attract people to Krishna consciousness. There's a, in Hyderabad, when Srila Prabhupada was in Hyderabad, he went to, there was some program, and the prasadam was very poor quality. They hadn't spent on it, they hadn't cooked it properly, the quantities, the quality, everything. Srila Prabhupada spent about an hour, you know, going over it very, very strongly. How disappointed. He told them, you know, I'm disappointed. He was angry that they would do that. You know, he at one stage, you know, he was saying, you know, here people have come, you know, with a lot of austerity to, you know, our program, you know, at their own expense and what have you, and, you know, this is what we, you know, and many of them are very, very respectable persons, and, you know, this is what we are offering them, a very, very low standard. He said that, you know, some of it was not quite fit, even the dogs, even for the dogs, you know, they would probably look at it and, you know, turn their nose, like, you know, that's a fact. He was very, very angry. And he said to them, you know, you know, I will pay, if it's a question of money, whatever you want, I will personally give you the money. You just cook the prasadam and you make it nice. So there's no question of money, because I'm going to personally give you whatever you need. because they should be collecting themselves. But sure, Prabhupada was insistent that there's no way they could say, oh, we can't afford or what have you, because if they need it, sure, Prabhupada, no, it will be there, the money will be there. So you see, in that sense, that for the service of Krishna, and especially for preaching, which is particularly the most dear service that Krishna accepts, as he says in the Bhagavad Gita, that one who preaches is Krishna consciousness. There is no servant more dear to me than he, nor will there ever be one more dear. We have our ISKCON bullets, the gulab jamuns, ISKCON bullets they call them. So that's our weaponry against Maya. You know, Vrishabha is very, very powerful. Everyone is struggling with Maya, and they're all losing the battle. The devotees come in with their, firing their bullets, shooting down Maya with their gulab jamuns. And, surprising, people eat these, the prasadam, and they just have such strength, gives them such strength to turn away from Maya and turn towards Krishna. They're very, very powerful. So as we see, in summary, we may... there's no use wasting our life for material happiness, because happiness comes very easily, and whatever we need is supplied by Krishna so very easily. It is a futile attempt to work so hard. In fact, what happens is people miss the happiness which is right there under their nose, and take to a process which is very difficult, with a lot of suffering, searching out after a happiness which never comes. Don't take that. Just accept what comes of its own accord, and that gives one an entire lifetime full of freedom and opportunity and energy and time, and then one can put one's full energy and concentration and vigor and thought and devotion into serving Krishna at that. So if anyone has any questions or comments? So you're saying is it Madhavendra Puri and who else?
And the Brahman who the white man who was lying down and Prahlada.
I see, So you're saying there are exceptions? So you're saying there are exceptions because they did endeavor strongly for something, or they did not endeavor.
But in the end of
according to one's level of spiritual advancement, of course, one will require more facility than others. So, for instance, Srila Prabhupada would sleep between 4 to 5 hours per day. 4 minimum, 5 maximum, generally. He slept a couple of hours at night, and then he would also take rest. So, 2 to 3 hours at night, and then he would take rest during the lunch, after lunch, I think it was. So, his average was about 4 or 5 hours a day. and sometimes the opportunity for sleep doesn't come because a devotee is, you know, doing so much service. Sometimes the opportunity to sit and eat, devotees preaching in different parts of the world, of course, sometimes they can eat nicely, there's a temple, and sometimes they're preaching in Siberia or something, and it's very difficult to even get food at all, you know, little bare necessities of prasad, and sometimes they go without, they have to fast, just not able to get anything. We see that Raghunath Das Goswami, you know, every few days he might have a little buttermilk, just a few, you know, a couple of sips of buttermilk. And he may make some endeavour to have that buttermilk every couple of days. Whereas, according to one's spiritual advancement, one's endeavour for what is their bare minimum may differ. So those who are very, very advanced, no bodily concept at all, there's hardly any endeavour, sometimes practically nil, and they can quite easily maintain their spiritual activities and spiritual consciousness. Others, for the bare minimum, so that their mind is satisfied and their body is satisfied, their minimum requirements, there may be certainly a little bit more endeavour. It's when we want. Our endeavour goes beyond that, that we're perhaps, contravening this principle of accepting what comes of its own accord, with just a little endeavour. So that's one part of it. At the same time, because we are preachers in the Krishna consciousness movement, if a sage is laying down like a python and just accepting whatever food comes, they may not be actively, generally they're not preaching, they're just, but for preachers, they have to, eat in such a way and sleep and rest and keep their body, fit and strong, in such a way that they've got full energy, and clarity of mind, because when there's not enough, food and water and rest, the mind doesn't think so well, depending on what level of devotional service we're on. And therefore, just like Srila Prabhupada he was talking about fasting on a codicil, and they asked him, what is the meaning of codicil? Srila Prabhupada said, a codicil just means fasting from everything, including water, and just chanting 24 hours. So I said, you do nothing else, you sit, you chant, no eating, no drinking, that's a codicil. So then, Tamal Krishnamaraj asked him, about the preachers, and Srila Prabhupada said, no, for the preachers, that is a different thing. He said, the preacher, they're beyond the rules and regulations. He said, be careful how you take that, right? It's not like you can break the four regular principles and what have you, but he was saying they are so exalted that they are beyond all these rules and regulations. He then told the story of Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, who you know, one of his disciples was not feeling so well, and he was fasting for codicy, and therefore he couldn't go out and preach. And Srila Bhakti said, Siddhanta said, no, feed him immediately and send him out to preach like that. So as we said, you know, before, that we have to take these verses and with common sense apply it in the right place. It has one application for society at large, how they're wasting their whole life and not devoting any time, or just, you know, not enough to spiritual life. It has a general application to devotees in general, and then that varies with devotees at different levels, and then it has another application of preachers. So with common sense we can take this instruction and apply it to everyone appropriately. When there's no common sense, what happens is we apply the same rules to the common person in the street, to the new devotee, to the, you know, advanced devotee, to the preacher, to the vijari. We apply just the same rule. Everyone should be doing the same thing like this. And that's where the problem starts. Oh, I read this in Srimad Bhagavatam, you know, like this. So, you know, Srimad Bhagavatam, there are 18,000 verses. And they all complement each other. If we take this verse here, we have to take it in context with the entire chapter, and we also have to take it in context with the entire canto, and ultimately with the entire 12 cantos of Srimad Bhagavatam. Doing that, then it's possible to apply this verse to every, you know, situation. If we just take the one verse out of context with the chapter, the canto, the Srimad Bhagavatam, or the modern context of preaching, there is no way that we can understand it. We cannot apply it at all on any platform. Therefore, for most of us, because we're not expert in the understanding of the entire Srimad Bhagavatam and how that is applied in Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement, preaching Krishna consciousness all over the world, therefore we just simply take the directions of one who does, that is the Acharyas, Srila Prabhupada, and we just see how that by following the regular activities of the general devotees in the temple, where from different levels, these things are automatically applied. Yeah. And especially when we preach Krishna consciousness, means if we preach Krishna consciousness, usually we're associating with advanced devotees. We're helping young devotees, and we're coming in contact with the general mass of people, and therefore we're applying this at all different levels, and it becomes very easy to see this verse in practice at all those different levels. So the best thing is to preach Krishna consciousness and gradually this understanding unfolds in its proper context. What is that, sorry?
The operator of the body and the mind.
Yes.
So I was just wondering about who is this? Is it that the Paramatma form of the law, or the self takes off?
The soul.
Because in the Bhagavad Gita it says Sarvastra Charam Sutta is to Vastati Jnana Kumanicha. So the Jnana part of it, the intelligence situation, they produce things like that. So Lord himself.
Yeah, but the Lord is supplying that intelligence to who? Tesham Sadadalam Yukdalam. He's actually supplying that intelligence to his devotee, and his devotee is using it. So it comes back to the self, who is, you know, therefore I gave the example of Srila Prabhupada using a typewriter. It was Srila Prabhupada's, you know, his level of consciousness as the operator of the vehicle of the body, brain, mind was so elevated that he used even a very aged body to perform, you know, amazing feats within a short period of time. So again, you know, the operator of the body. So that was Srila Prabhupada's individual ability to utilize the vehicle he was in, and the intelligence to do that, of course, was you know, being given unlimitedly because of his relationship with the Supreme Lord Krishna. But you know, we don't say that Krishna spread generally when we read these books, we say purport by his divine grace Srila Prabhupada. We don't say purport by the super soul, you know. Because of if our consciousness is purified, then we're associating with the Supreme Lord, and therefore we can, you know, operate the body, the brain, the mind within the material world very wonderfully. If our consciousness is you know, very dull, very covered, then certainly we don't have a very strong connection with the super soul, and our ability to operate is very limited because of a lack of, you know, common sense and what have you. Even though the, you know, the brain may be quite a, you know, in perfect order and capable of genius thoughts and what have you. So yeah, we're talking, and when Srila Prabhupada was discussing that on a morning walk, he was talking, you know, the self or the operator as you know, the jiva. But you know, having said that, we understand that any action is performed in conjunction with the assistance of the super soul or Krishna. So that's it. You know, for instance, when we take a walk, we might say, "I'm going for a walk," but we don't say, "I'm going for a walk because the sun is in the sky and, you know, there's just, you know, there's a certain amount of oxygen in the air," and you know, we don't necessarily have to describe the full background of the universe which is supporting our ability to walk. It's understood, it's there, but we're still walking. And similarly, yes, certainly there's the backdrop of the spiritual impetus coming in, but still we're, the spirit soul is operating. So it's understood, but it's not necessarily always has to be stated. Any other comments or questions? Thank you. Hare Krishna.